It's the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I believe that we all know well that this is not a normal time and that the threats to our democracy from within and without are real. And none of us can say with confidence how the situation that we now find ourselves in will turn out.
Our commitment, 100%, is to stay in downtown Phoenix and to come to a resolution with that. The reality of the sports environment is that if we can't come to any kind of a conclusion or any kind of an agreement, we don't know what the future will hold.
I have support for the bill, and I will do my job as a legislator by introducing a bill that I think the voters in Arizona support, and I think I've got support from members.
We want to make sure that we protect the levels in Lake Mead. We make certain that the state speaks with one voice, and we make certain that one water user doesn't benefit over another.
And with us to talk about both of Arizona's current U.S. senators saying goodbye to the chamber, the controversy over the Suns arena renovation deal, and other top stories from this week are Marcus Delartino, a partner at First Strategic Communications and Public Affairs, and former Arizona House Minority Leader David Lujan, currently director of the Arizona Center for Economic Progress. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So we have to start with John Kyle, one of the U.S. senators who is saying goodbye. We heard the announcement this morning that he'll be stepping down at the end of the month. Marcus, we talked to Yvonne Winjet from The Republic last hour and commented that this really isn't much of a surprise because he's only committed to staying through the end of this year. Not much of a surprise, really, that he's stepping down now, is it?
No, I think there were high hopes that maybe he could be lobbied into staying a little bit longer. But, I think we forget a little bit that John Kyle's getting a little bit older, and he's served in the Senate and served very well the state of Arizona for a number of years. And I think it's, you know, he wants to go spend time with his grandkids and his wife and enjoy life. And he's certainly entitled to that.
Did you get the sense that the governor wanted him to stay on longer?
I did get that sense. And I think there's a lot of Arizonans that would love to have him stay on longer. There's no doubt. When you look at his record, when you look at his knowledge, he was a former leadership post in the United States Senate and from Arizona, well-versed in every foreign affairs, judiciary. I mean, the list goes on and on, all the issues that are important to Arizona. It's a loss for Arizona.
David, it's tough to assess a legacy over the course of 4 months that he was in this seat, but there were some big things that happened while he was in the Senate. How do you sort of look at his role in some of them, not, as Marcus pointed out, in leadership anymore, but still, you know, one member in a very, very slim majority?
Yeah, well, I think he did what he was, I think, appointed to do. His main task, I think, was the Supreme Court justice vote, and he did that. And you know, I think when you're talking about Senator Kyle, you're not looking at just the last 4 months, but his entire career, even, you know, when he served before. And I think Marcus is right. It is, you know, I think we will miss the experience that he brings to the job and the clout that he brings for Arizona. And now it's going to be interesting to see who the governor appoints to fill that slot.
We'll talk about that in a second, but I want to ask one more question about this. So how much does this shift things in terms of the power dynamic for Arizona? When John McCain passed, I know we had some conversations on the show about losing somebody who was that well-respected, who was that famous on an international stage, and then Kyle sort of could fill that role in a different way than many others might be able to.
Yeah, I think, you know, Arizona has been very fortunate to have a strong congressional delegation in the past, and I think we've lost some of that with, you know, the retirements and other things. So it's going to take a while to build up some of that clout. You know, I really, you know, Kyrsten Sinema and I served together in the legislature, and she's one of the hardest working people that I have ever met in my life. So I think it's only a matter of time before she builds up some of that clout for Arizona. But I think, you know, we are going to see a drop off a little bit for a while until we get some of that experience from our congressional delegation.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, when you take a look at our losses, you know, Senator John Kyle, Senator John McCain, Ed Pastor, who ran appropriations, and you just go back historically and you start to look at whether it's Carl Hayden or the Rhodes family or who it may be, you know, our congressional delegation now is so new and has lost so much seniority. We've got a long way to go to get back to those days where we're making a significant mark on the Hill.
Yeah, I guess Kyrsten Sinema becomes the senior senator when she's sworn in, senior basically by default, right? Because there might not be another senator there. Marcus, do you get the sense that the governor is looking for, before we get into any potential names, do you think that he would want somebody, or do you think he should want somebody who would try to run for that seat in 2020 when he makes this next appointment?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt about it. But that's a far more complicated task than it sounds. Mm-hmm. And the reason is people need to know that there's two more elections that need to happen to get back on the cycle. So remember, the United States Senate is a six-year term. We've been knocked off the traditional six-year term because of the death of Senator McCain and the appointment process and then John Kyle. So you've got to run in 2020. And so you're looking at roughly $20 million, I think, candidates spent this time. So $20 million to raise in 2020. And then you have to run again in 2022 and probably raise another $20 million. So the question you need to ask is, who has the ability to raise that type of money? The list gets pretty short.
David, do you think that would you agree that the idea is for somebody who would not be a placeholder? Because I think most people would have seen Senator Kyle as a placeholder. He said he wasn't really interested in running again. So would you assume that the governor is looking for somebody who would be appointed and then run again in 2020 and then probably again in 2022?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's exactly what he's doing. And I think Marcus is exactly right. You're looking for somebody who's going to be able to raise the money and who's going to be able to win that seat in 2020 and 2022. And I think that's a pretty short list of potential candidates that could fill that slot.
So who's on that short list?
Well, I think I know the a lot of people think it's going to be Martha McSally. I think we could see a Senator Kirk Adams or maybe a Senator Eileen Klein. Those would be my three top choices right now, and I think probably a lot of people's.
I'm right here.
Sorry, Senator Delatino. Yeah.
My mom would have a heart attack. You know, and I would throw in Leah Marquez Peterson from Tucson.
Who ran in the CD2 race.
She ran in the CD2 race. And Bill Montgomery, certainly been talked about a lot lately. And Karen Kinosik Taylor was talked about not all that too long ago. So there's a long list out there of people who are certainly interested. I know that the governor's office is certainly getting a lot of pressure from Washington, D.C. for Martha McSally. You know, Mitch McConnell's invested a lot of money on her behalf, and I think he'd like to see her in the Senate. But, you know, this governor, I think, is cautious to say, I'm going to do what's in the best interest of Arizona, not necessarily what is in the best interest of what somebody in Washington, D.C. wants.
Would that be as controversial as I think it would be if he tried to appoint Martha McSally after she just lost the election for the same seat or for the other seat?
Yeah, I don't think you can get away from the controversy there because that'll be the headline, right?
Right.
And I think the counterpoint will be, well, it was a close race and, you know, X millions of voters voted for her and certainly the Republicans wanted her to win the primary. But, you know, it's also the other way to look at it is it's an opportunity for the Republican Party to bring in fresh blood and who else can run and build that farm team going into the next elections. And sometimes that's how I choose to look at those options.
How important do you think it would be to the governor to appoint somebody who has run a campaign before in terms of trying to be able to raise the amount of money that would be needed and sort of know what they're doing going into two elections, as you say, before we sort of get back on that six-year cycle?
Well, you know, I wouldn't be as worried about somebody who hasn't run before. I would be more worried about somebody who doesn't have the capacity to raise that kind of money.
Yeah.
And so that's your first bar. You can always hire a political consultant. And you can go hire, you know, campaign managers and communications people. And that part, that infrastructure gets figured out eventually. But the ability to raise that kind of money and make those phone calls, that's going to be the first bar. And then, of course, you want somebody who's, you know, not a political novice and is completely new to politics and has some, you know, has a sense of Arizona and its history of Arizona.
Yeah, that's why I think, you know, Kirk Adams, Eileen Klein, I think they both fit that bill. Martha McSally does as well. One thing I think, you know, Martha McSally, there was some friction, I think, between Senator McCain and Martha McSally. So I wonder how much that plays into it in terms of, you know, what the McCain family would want to see. And, if, you know, so I think I still tend to think that Kirk Adams is going to get it.
And Kirk Adams, we should remember, in addition to running in the legislature, ran a congressional campaign as well, was unsuccessful, but sort of has experience on the federal level running a campaign. Mm-hmm. There's some reporting in the Washington Post that suggests that the governor's office is seemingly less interested now in McSally maybe than it had been, despite the lobbying of Mitch McConnell. Some thought that maybe the memo that was leaked, the postmortem on her campaign that was leaked, wasn't looked at quite so favorably. On the ninth floor at the Capitol. David, how much should any of that play into the governor's decision, do you think?
Well, I think it will play into it. I think, you know, he's going to make a decision, as Marcus said, that's going to be in what he thinks is the best interest for Arizona, but also what he thinks for the person who he thinks can win in 2020. And so I think if you know, she's putting together this memo, which is putting together a lot of excuses and maybe not taking responsibility, maybe that plays into, you know, is she going to be a viable candidate in 2020 if I appoint her to that seat? And, you know, she's already lost once. And so that might be a notch against her.
I'm glad you brought up that memo because it allows me to go off just for a second. Because
please do.
Hey, listen, if you are a political professional and you're in the campaign business, stop using the word that you're the CEO of a campaign. There is no chief executive officer of a campaign. You're either the campaign manager, the campaign consultant, you're in fundraising, or you're in comms. But that storyline in these campaigns just sends the wrong message to people. This campaigns are not a private business where we're trading stocks and equity. And so elevating your title to make yourself feel better is just it tells you too much about the campaign that they're running and not in a good way.
Does anyone want to take bets right now on who it's going to be? Bets on lunch or something, right?
Yeah.
I'm just for glory.
I'm going to go with the longer shot, which is Kirk Adams.
Okay.
I have gone back and forth on every single candidate. I am not going to make a pick, especially because it's going to get me. It'd be a lot easier for me to make a pick on the Democrat side, let me tell you, than it would on the Republican side. So I'm going to hush up and just say it will not be Marcus Dell'Artino.
Wow. You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Along those lines, I mean, let me ask you, though, because, you know, we saw a Democrat elected to the Senate for the first time in a long, long time just last month. When the governor's looking at which of these people he wants to put in that seat, I would imagine that he's looking at who might be coming along on the Democratic side. There's some names that are being tossed about as potential candidates. Is he looking at potential matchups like Republican X versus Democrat X, Republican X versus Democrat Y? Is he looking at potential matchups?
You know, I think that plays, you know, that plays later in the decision making. You know, I think it's hard to do that, and I would caution anybody against that because the life in politics changes dramatically in 24 hours, right? So yesterday we didn't know John Kyle was going to retire, and today we do. So when you sit there and you think of you know, is it going to be Grant Woods? Is it going to be Ruben Gallego? You might be putting too much machinations into what just makes a good candidate and a good senator. And I think that should be your primary concern.
And I think whoever it's going to be, I think it's going to be a decision that'll be fairly quick just because I think they want to have somebody in place when the new Senate takes office January 2nd, January 3rd. Got Christmas coming up. So I'm guessing he's going to make his appointment sometime in the next week or so.
All right, that's David Lujan. Also here, Marcus Dell'Artino. I'm Mark Brody with Lauren Gilger. This is the Friday Newscap on the show. More conversation in just a minute. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap here on the show on KJZZ with Lauren Gilger in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. We're joined in studio this morning by David Lujan, director of the Arizona Center for Economic Progress, former State House Minority Leader, and Marcus Dell'Artino, a partner at First Strategic Communications and Public Affairs and not a future U.S. Senator from Arizona, at least not yet. So, guys, let's talk about Arizona's other U.S. Senator who said goodbye this week. Jeff Flake served one term, gave his farewell address yesterday. Marcus, how do you look at the time that Senator Flake served in the Senate? He certainly, especially over the last couple of years, made quite a name for himself.
Yeah, and I think that that's gonna be the defining of Jeff Flake, right? Not the early years, not the pork barrel spending, limiting pork barrel spending,
earmarks
limiting earmarks. That really will not be sort of his legacy. It will be more about the last 2 years and fighting with Donald Trump and decency in the U.S. Senate and how they handle themselves. And that type of dialogue will probably define him more than his earlier years.
David, what do you think?
I agree. I think the civility and decency he brought to the Senate will be what people remember, particularly in these Trump years. Certainly, I disagree with him on just about every policy issue, but I think the decency and civility that he has brought to Congress or has tried to bring to Congress is very valuable in these times.
When we talk about sort of civility and going up against Donald Trump, it can't be much of a surprise that he used a decent percentage of his farewell address yesterday to basically do that. He didn't mention Trump by name, I don't believe, but saying that, we're kind of in a perilous moment here and we need to sort of figure this out and, ride this through and get back on track here.
Yeah. I think he has been sort of that voice that unfortunately we have not heard enough of from the Republican side of the aisle, really challenging Trump and challenging this political culture that we have these days. And so, that I think is good. I would have liked to have seen him back that up by more votes, voting against sort of the Trump agenda. But one thing I can think you can say about Senator Flake is that he is very much a conservative, very much, sticks to what he believes. And so, but he also is very much somebody who believes in having a civil process, treating people well. And he's always represented himself in that way. And so for that, I think we can be very proud that, he was our member of Senate.
Is this the last, though, that we have heard from Senator Flake?
Yeah, that's interesting.
There's been plenty of speculation that he will throw his hat in the ring in 2020. Any thoughts there?
I don't think he'd have much of a chance. I mean, I think, obviously Democrats disagree with him on just about every policy issue. And I think on the Republican side, he's angered enough people on, and so I just don't think that. But it is curious. I wonder what he will do next. But I don't think he's going to be running for office successfully again.
I think you'll either see him in New Hampshire or you will see him as a permanent guest on MSNBC.
Those are my two
MSNBC guesses.
But
you,
is a good call.
You have not heard the last of him. There's no doubt.
With Jeff Flake leaving, and to an extent Bob Corker from Tennessee leaving, are there voices left in the U.S. Senate on the Republican side who will sort of play that role of foil to the president, calling him out when they think it's necessary?
Well, there's certainly less of them, I'll tell you that, but I think that there's still a few left. I mean, Ben Sasse, I don't think, is any shrinking wallflower from Nebraska. And he has a sense of humor about him. But there's certainly less of it that's going to happen. But, I took Flake's speech a little bit bigger picture than – I didn't look at it as an attack on Trump, which I think we're sort of used to from him now. But, there is a – there is democracy. The discussion is under attack in several areas, not just this what he's used to in the conversation with the White House, but when you look at what Russia is doing globally, and when you look at other countries, third world countries, and how their governments are performing, and even things that are happening on Capitol Hill, I think he's got a valid point that we need to be vigilant, watching out for democracy in every aspect.
What do you think he's going to be looking for in terms of making a decision on 2020? Because he's been pretty clear that somebody from the Republican Party should challenge Trump, and he hopes somebody does. He's not saying it's not going to be me, although he, of course, has said it's not him. What factors will he consider, do you think, when making the decision, it should be me or it will not be me?
I think the first factor he's going to consider is his family, frankly. He's very much a family man, and I think he's one of those guys that actually takes it to heart. There's a lot of people that pay lip service to that, but I think for him it's actually a valid concern, that's a smart idea when you're running for president of the United States. But I think he's also going to talk to John Kasich, frankly. and see if he thinks John's got a legitimate shot, which he doesn't, but they're going to have that conversation. And maybe he thinks he's going to be of help to him somewhere there.
All right. So let's move on to one of the other big stories from this week. And that has to do with the Phoenix City Council. If I might mix my sports metaphors, punting on the decision on a renovation deal for Talking Stick Resort Arena. David, what do you make of this whole thing? I mean, the Suns clearly want a new, not a new building, but this building to be upgraded and updated. Robert Sarver said yesterday that he is committed to staying in Phoenix. What do you think has to happen to get enough city council members comfortable with this deal to get them to support it?
Yeah, well, I'll start by saying I'm a huge Suns fan, a lifetime Suns fan. I think I was at the very first Suns game at what was then America West Arena. Mm-hmm. It was Charles Barkley's first home game as a Phoenix Sun. And that was a great season. I mean, they went on to the World Championship Series. They lost it to the Chicago Bulls. But it was also at a time where we had a different owner that really invested in the team and was really, I think, committed to winning. And I don't think we have seen that with Sarver. And so I think it's a mistake for the city of Phoenix to put, at least under this current deal, to pay as much for the renovations at the arena as what has been proposed. Certainly, I think it's okay for the city to put in some dollars because the city gets some benefits. But, you know, I think it's too much, particularly when you think that Sarver, the value of the team, I think, has increased by like $900 million or something since he purchased it back in 2004. What I think is, you know, what's the rush? We have a mayor's election coming up in March. We have most of the city council, I believe, is up for election. Let's make this a topic of the election cycle and let them, you know, Kate Gallego has already made very clear where she stands on this issue. And let the voters, when they're voting for the mayor and the city council, make this an issue. And then, you know, then we'll see what happens after that.
Even coming from a lifelong Suns fan, there you go. Would it make a difference? I mean, if the Suns were winning right now, if they were doing better or if they had a different owner, like you're saying?
I think if we had an owner that showed a commitment to winning, I don't think that Sarver has done that. That I think would make some difference. But, you know, I think we need to get away from giving corporations all these big tax breaks anyway, not just for sports stadiums, but the city of Phoenix and many other cities are constantly giving property tax giveaways. And it makes no sense. You know, why should we should be standing on the, you know, what makes us as a good city? Let's be investing in our education system, investing in parks and those types of things. And so I just think it's a mistake to be giving big tax giveaways to rich owners.
I mean, I couldn't – what David's referencing is giblets, and I couldn't agree with him more on that policy. It's just – it's been abused, and it needs to be sort of fixed. But, you know, I think that on the Suns, there's more to this story, and I think that we're looking at this through the lens of sort of the last year, and we've forgotten that there's some history involved here. And at the end of the day, you know, he put in – the first time he put in more money than the city of Phoenix. So when you take into consideration this offer, it's really a 50-50 split. Number one. And number two, if we take out the just forget about the fact that it's sports team and we're emotional about sports teams. This is the city of Phoenix entered into an agreement. They built a city building. It is a city building, and there's infrastructure in there that needs to be updated, right? So there, the city does have some financial responsibility here, which I'm not too sure has actually been really dove into that sort of legality issues here in the news media, but there is some liability that the taxpayers have. So at the end of the day, I think we're going to come to an agreement. I think the Suns are going to stay. He wants to stay here, but at some point we do need to have a bigger discussion, and it probably will never happen because it's just a little bit too much forethought here. But as a region, and maybe that region's Maricopa County, maybe it's bigger than Maricopa County. What do we do with all of these facilities that are government-owned, that are aging, and need infrastructure improvements? And so that would go for all the stadiums and the professional sports teams. And is there a revenue source somewhere that satisfies that need? Or how do we handle these in the future? Because right now we're handling them on a case-by-case basis. And it sets up, you know, it sets up a disaster for the taxpayer at the end of the day. If the Suns ended up leaving, you know, the city of Phoenix would try to recruit the Coyotes from Glendale. So you leave the taxpayers in Glendale with a $100 million bill that they have to pay. That's not fair. And so we need to start sort of thinking a little bit, not just on a team-by-team basis, but on a state basis, how we're going to deal with these facilities.
Well, it seems like that would be a good conversation to have here now, because three of the Valley's four sports teams are talking about new or renovated buildings mm-hmm. between the Coyotes, the Suns, and the Diamondbacks. Seems like the time might be ripe for that kind of conversation.
I agree. And then don't forget, we've got things like Super Bowl. Okay, and those costs to win a Super Bowl to come in is, you know, millions and millions of dollars that the private sector is trying to raise the money for, but it's very difficult to compete with all of these cities to win great things like Super Bowls, Fiesta Bowls, Final Four, and that could be part of the discussion too.
All right. Unfortunately, we'll have to leave it right there. That's Marcus Dellartino, a partner at First Strategic Communications and Public Affairs. We're also joined this morning by former Arizona House Minority Leader David Lujan, currently director of the Arizona Center for Economic Progress. Guys, thanks a lot for coming in. Good conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.